This is John Abrams, and this is the Variety Artist, episode 51. I was first introduced to Avner's work when my friend Suzanne Herring said, "Come to a workshop I'm taking. It's with Avner Eisenberg. It's going to be amazing." I didn't go to that workshop, and now, after talking to Avner and listening back to this interview, I'm kicking myself. I'm definitely not missing him next time he's in LA. Now, if you get a chance, check out Avner's routines. Well, I can't call them routines. You'll hear why on the interview. Watch the videos on YouTube, especially the napkin eating one. It's a classic and we talk a lot about it. And if you feel like going down the Avner the Eccentric rabbit hole, go for it. Like Chris Sharp said on my Facebook group, literally one of the best 10-minute videos available on YouTube. Enjoy the interview.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
My guest today is hailed as one of the greatest clowns of all time. His extensive career spans Broadway, TV, movies, and just about every theater in the U.S. and abroad. In addition to a busy performance schedule, he has taught master classes in clowning and eccentric performing in the United States, France, Germany, Finland, Belgium, Japan, and Spain. Variety Artist, I give you Avner Eisenberg.
Hi, John.
How's it going, Avner?
Oh, quite well for a cold day. It was 5 degrees this morning when I got up, but it's up to 18 now.
We complain in Southern California when it's under like 65. Joel Siegel from ABC TV talks about you, and he says, "I laughed for 2 hours. The show only lasted an hour and a half."
Yeah, that was my favorite quote, too.
Tell us, what exactly is clowning? I know I've seen clowning, and I know clowning, but I couldn't define it.
It's kind of like the Supreme Court said. Clowning is a lot like pornography. You can't define it, but you know it when you see it.
Exactly. I was looking at a bunch of your different videos, and I was seeing some performance videos when you did your famous slack rope routine, and also the napkin eating routine, of course. But I noticed that in some of your workshop videos and some of your older videos, you were wearing the clown nose, and now you don't. What does the clown nose represent?
Well, it's an interesting question and an interesting story of why clowns wear red noses. And if there were an international road symbol for clown, I think it would be the red nose and big shoes. To understand the red nose, you have to go back to the beginning of circus in America and realizing that until the middle of the 1800s, nothing on earth moved faster than a horse could walk.
Yeah.
The original circuses were horse shows. And the population was very much an agricultural population. There weren't big cities, there weren't factories. What happened in the mid-1800s was the invention of the steam engine, the Industrial Revolution, and the attraction of people off the small family farms into the cities. So we were very much an agrarian society. Every small family farm had a horse or a mule. And the one thing I think every farm kid knew was that you don't stand up on a horse. And I think lots of people had broken bones to prove it.
Okay.
So when these circuses came around, and this goes back to ancient Rome, the first circuses were really horse shows. Hmm. People bareback riding, trick riding. Now we still have the bareback riders and the very exciting doing gymnastic moves on the horse. In fact, that's why the gymnastics horse is called a horse, because it was based on equestrian moves that people did on the pommels. And there's all pommels, come to think of it. So these first shows had these incredible feats happening on horses. You know that the circus is the world of the virtuoso. Circus performers do things that we can't even imagine.
Yeah.
We know from the study of drama that we need a character, at least one character, who we can feel empathy for. Empathy rather than sympathy. Sympathy means that you understand what they're going through, but you don't really feel it. Empathy means you feel what they're feeling. Sure. We don't understand how a person can stand up on a horse galloping around the ring, going into a cage full of lions and tigers, going 30 feet in the air, walking on a tightrope. We can't really understand that. So we're stuck with the spectacle of it, but no real human connection, no rapport is established. So they've developed a character. And the word clown, as I understand it, it comes from an old Danish word that means a rustic or a country person. Mm-hmm. So this would have been a kind of a farm worker who came to the circus, not particularly clean, not educated, who wanders into the ring. When a person in spangly tights and with a cape goes into the ring and says, I'm going to stand on this horse and do a double back flip, we go, okay, go ahead, go for it. But when a farm worker, one of our people, wanders into the ring, we go, oh my gosh, no, wait, don't do that. So it takes a certain lack of inhibition to go into a circus ring. And this disinhibited character is really the essence of the clown. Now, in our culture, there's a substance that we drink that takes away inhibition, and that's alcohol. And the symbol of alcoholism is the red nose.
Oh.
That's why clowns wear red noses. I know it's not true, but it's what I believe.
Oh.
And then the big shoes is another one. Big shoes and a kind of motley costume. And there's a more sort of socioeconomic interpretation of the clown. Well, first of all, there's the image of the little child in walking around in his father's shoes.
Oh, okay.
Very reminiscent of the clown. But there's also, in the old days, people couldn't afford shoes. They were all bespoke. There weren't any. You couldn't go down to the shoe store, and so rich people would throw away shoes. And you'd have to get some that you could wear. So they were always too big. They had holes in them. There were no colorful clothing. People who didn't have money wore plain homespun clothing. And when rich people threw away colorful garments that they'd had made for them, the poorer people would pick these up. And especially the sort of clochard or disenfranchised person. So you end up with this sort of outcast of society walking around in someone else's off-cast clothes and big shoes and always drunk. So we have the red nose coming back. I kind of like that theory. I first heard that from Leo Bassi, and it's a nice idea about the, not just the derivation of the clown, but the psychological need for the clown to give us a character that we can have empathy for.
It represents the audience member watching, like you're saying, you know, an acrobatic horse rider, you say, wow, great. But when you see some random guy with big shoes and possibly a little drunk, a wander on and do something amazing, it's way more amazing.
And in a sense, emotionally much more satisfying. That's what we take home. And that's what we as performers all want the audience to take home is a memory of the performer, not the performance.
Exactly. That's what Bob Fitch was just talking about a couple of weeks ago with the interview that I did with him, going home with the person, not the trick.
Yeah. Bob's a genius too.
He is a genius. All right, so let's talk about some of your routines. I know you're known for specific routines and things, but the thing that I appreciate the most out of your routines is how you string together each routine. So instead of, you know, one routine and then going into the next routine and then going to the next routine, it is one giant routine strung together beautifully by motivation of going from one to the other. Talk about that.
Well, first of all, I used to call them routines as well. And my Italian-born French agent said, you shouldn't call them routines, they're numbers. To say that something is routine is like putting it on autopilot, and it's just routine. So I always call them numbers, the little bits of the show numbers now.
Okay. I might start doing that too.
To go back to your original question, how do you define clowning? The first thing is that I've come to the conclusion there's no such thing as a clown, but there is clowning. Clowning is a verb. It's something that anyone can do, from a straight actor to a person who's dressed as, quote unquote, a clown. And it has to do with attitudes basically to problem solving and viewing everything that we do on stage as a problem to be solved. And then we can say that clowns solve complicated problems in simple ways and simple problems in complicated ways.
Okay.
But I remember when I was helping my late wife put together her first one-woman show called Woman in a Suitcase, which, by the way, you can see it. It's linked on my webpage. If you click on the cover of her book, it takes you to a page our son and I made in her memory. Her videos are linked there. It's an absolutely brilliant show.
Terrific.
We took all of her numbers and put them on index cards. These were the words, and we were trying to make sentences out of them. And we said, okay, here, these are the things that we like, that we want to happen. What story can they tell? And how can they tell it? So she had one number that came from a 1980s sensibility about a woman getting a makeover. Mm-hmm. And it was a German, and absolutely hilarious, totally politically incorrect, a woman who uses, as she puts it, mere hangovers from the refrigerator. And it's, I can't remember the name of the artist who made portraits out of vegetables and food stuff. So she put all this basically yogurt and beaten eggs and flour and cucumbers all over her face.
Uh-huh.
And we said, well, we like the number, but it's so, by the time we were working on this in the late 90s, it was so kind of anti-feminist that it just really wouldn't fly, but we still liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I do recommend in working on a show is to do lots of test shows for small audiences. So we live on an island off the coast of Maine, and we did a series of shows for about 10 people each. And one of the old nuns who lives on the island came up after the show and said, I didn't get that thing with the food. Was that the in-flight movie? And we went, no. And then we looked at each other and went, yes, it was. We simply repackaged it. We reframed it so that it became a little show within the show, and then it became acceptable.
Oh.
I forget what the question is, but that was my answer.
Well, no, that's okay. It doesn't matter. Let's talk about that newspaper tear. Now, as a magician, I'm a magician myself, and I've seen the newspaper tear done a thousand times. Someone brings out a newspaper, tears it up, voila, it's back to normal. But you have actually found a reason for the newspaper tear that really has nothing to do with the newspaper itself, right?
Actually, if you'll think back, you'll realize you've never seen me tear a newspaper. I simply restore one. This developed. There was a thread online a couple of months ago. Someone was wondering about that concept of just restoring pieces of paper to a full paper, and citing other magicians who had done it. And it turns out that I invented it back in the early 80s. I was in a production of Comedy of Errors with the Flying Karamazov brothers,
mm-hmm.
that was opened at the Goodman Theater. We played at the Olympic Arts Festival, and we ran on Broadway. And then we're broadcast live from Lincoln Center, and you can see that too. I played the janitor of the theater, who sort of got trapped in the production.
Right.
And he came to me and said, I've got a challenge for you. I need you to get some laughs. People aren't understanding that this is a comedy. They're thinking Shakespeare. We need to break the fourth wall, and we need to explain the story. I came up with this route That's routine. Oh,
his number.
It took about three days to come up with the whole thing, and it was at dress rehearsal, sweeping the stage, trying to light a cigarette, failing miserably, the cigarettes, the matches, everything's on the floor. I just give up. And I sweep them into a trap door, and I've done my job. And as I leave, Shakespeare comes out of the trap, yeah, covered in cigarettes and matches, and dumps his trash can on the floor, which is presumably what he had been working on. I go over, pick up the pieces and look at them, and boom, it pops open into a what is basically the Gene Anderson newspaper restore.
Yeah.
Says a Syracuse merchant caught, and that begins the show. I liked it so much I plagiarized myself and developed it for my own show.
Well, let's talk about your workshops. You have some eccentric performing principles.
Yeah. Yeah. We used to call the work, I've been teaching for 28, this will be the 28th year. Julie and I taught together for 26. And then last year was the first year without her. And developed this whole pedagogy teaching at the Celebration Barn in South Paris, Maine. And there, this year we've expanded to 3 weeks. We'll do a intro and advanced, and then repeat the intro week because there's been a kind of an overflow. We used to call it clown, but it wasn't really accurate. A lot of people were afraid of it. They said, I don't want to be a clown. And a lot of people who were already clowns, but who I think had most of their emphasis was on makeup, costume, gags, rather than this sort of soul of a clown, which we were looking at. So we started calling it eccentric performing, also because it's much more inclusive. We've had everything from corporate HR people and trainers to professional circus clowns to actors who want to use some clowning in creating physical comedy in their work. Storytellers, singers, dancers, it really was a much more inclusive term and leads to a much more heterogeneous group every year.
Now, what are some of those principles, if you don't mind spilling a few here?
Well, the first principle, and I like starting from basic principles and then developing the whole system. The first principle is that the body tells the story. The body always tells the story, and any language that you use merely explains the story that the body already told. Now, for years, I watched people doing clown numbers that really should have been funny. Everything was correct. The timing, the use of props, the concept, and they weren't funny. I realized that the basic emotion that they were communicating to me as an audience was fear. And I started wondering about that, and I started asking, what are we afraid of? The easy answer is fear of failure, but clowns have to fail or they're not really doing their jobs.
Right.
And I started asking students, what's your basic, and I'll ask you the same question,
sure,
what's your basic emotional state when you're just before going on stage? And the overwhelming answer is, I hope it doesn't suck.
Okay.
And then I asked the question, how many of us have some anxiety about performing, and every hand goes up? Well, it doesn't have to be like that. But we have to deal with that anxiety, figure out why we have it, and some constructive things to do to alleviate it. I then started asking the sort of other side of the coin question. When you're in an audience, and I can attest to this because I went to a show just the other day, what's your basic emotional state when you're waiting for the show to start? And the answer is, I hope it doesn't suck. Here we've got two groups of people, the performers and the audience, and they're terrified of each other. And that's not a good situation.
So what do you suggest the performer do to change that?
There's a concept, I don't know if you're aware of this. I have a second career as a hypnotherapist?
I do. It's on my list of questions.
Okay. The reason I got interested in hypnotherapy, I had about 6 months off. I had shoulder surgery about 10 years ago. Had 6 months where I couldn't work. And I'd gotten interested in trance and hypnosis. Mm. I had noticed that both as a performer, as an audience member, well, separate things. As a performer, when a show really goes well, it's a kind of, you kind of go into a trance. It's a wonderful feeling. It just flows. But more so as an audience member, when a show really works, it's a trance experience. Trance being defined by time distortion, loss of body awareness, an agreeable acceptance of suggestions that we share the hallucination of the alternative reality that the performers propose to us in the story that they're telling. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to other performers and myself, performing feels more like a gambling game than a craft. There's, I hope they like it sort of a feeling. I would sometimes get that sort of trance reaction from the audience, sometimes not. And I wondered, what were the elements, what are the principles involved? And I know that hypnotists get that reaction every time. Mm-hmm. It's not a question. So I wanted to find out what they had to say about it. Another sort of sideline was that I had come to understand that hypnotherapy, and particularly Ericksonian hypnosis and NLP, probably the best treatment for anxiety, stress-related anxiety, stage fright. And I thought, maybe I would learn enough that I could help students with that. So I went and took a workshop. It was a 5-day training. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely hooked. I saw magic happen. And I started to change, very much change the way I perform and the way I teach from that experience. And then I got hooked on it, and I went back, and for about 5 years I traveled down to DC and did more and more trainings. I do a fair amount with students on the in other countries when I'm on tour. So the concept, and the first thing that a hypnotist does, is create what's called rapport. Mm-hmm. And that's a sympathetic relationship between two people. And you see it all the time. If you just go into a restaurant and look at people, you'll see who's in rapport and who is not. Mm-hmm. Characterized by that both people adopt the same posture, the same gestures, goes into tonality of voice, choice of words, timbre of voice, pitch. These things all line up. And when you're out of rapport, you see it right away. And boy, do you feel it when it happens. When you've had an argument with a really good friend, your whole body feels it.
Yeah.
So I would say now that the job of the performer is to create and maintain rapport with the audience. So that's the next principle. And we look at rapport and what it feels like to be in rapport and what it feels like to be out of rapport, and to start to become sensitized to when we're blocking the establishment of rapport.
Mm-hmm. It seems like when we think to ourselves as performers, that was a rough audience, it isn't necessarily a rough audience. It sounds like we just weren't in rapport with that particular audience.
That is often the case.
Huh. So is that the first principle, or is that one of the principles?
I think there are several wrapped up in there.
Let's talk more about your personal career. I was reading that you were the first solo clown to ever play on Broadway. Is that right?
I heard that too. I don't know if it's true, but I like it.
You like saying it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, take us back down to 1991, which was after the Broadway thing, and you won the New Faces Award in 1991, and you'd already been doing it for a number of years, right?
That was at Edinburgh.
Okay.
It was just the New Faces of Edinburgh. I actually got a good joke out of that one. I won this award. I think I won £1,000, and they had, and it was from the very conservative newspaper. I was also shortlisted for the what's called the Perrier Award, which was really quite the honor, sort of the Oscars of Edinburgh. It was really neat to be one of the five finalists in that. Anyhow, they gave me this, they had this big facsimile check, which I display of exuberance balanced on my chin, and that was on the front page of the newspaper.
Oh, great.
And then they said, I think it was £1,000 prize. They said, what are you going to do with all this money? I said, oh, I'm just going to keep doing my show till it's all gone.
That's good.
The next day, I took the check to the Bank of Scotland, said, I'd like to cash this. And he said, well, how do we know you're who you say you are?
Wait, did you take that big giant check down there?
I had a real one.
Oh, okay.
I went, oh, I don't have an account. Wait a minute. Do you have today's newspaper? Yes, we do. And there it was. So they cashed the check based on having my picture on the front page of the paper as my ID.
You're like, it's me. Look. Okay, so flash forward 10 years later, and you're inducted into the International Clown Hall of Fame. Or to 11 years later. That's a very short period of time from New Faces to International Clown Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it was nice. That was nice.
So when you got that call, was that a nice phone call?
Oh, about the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very nice. Very nice. I'm very happy and proud about that.
All right, well, we're going to ask a few random things that I saw on your bio. Maybe you can tell me a little more about it, because I read a little piece of it and it sounded very interesting. A couple things. First, you were once arrested in Paris for buffoonery in public.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Official encouragement. I was at the Lecoq School in Paris from 1971 to 74. Beautiful spring day. A friend and I had gotten a little street show together, and we went over to the Palais Chaillot, as in the Mad Woman of, and we were at the base by the fountains and doing a show, and there were probably 1,000 people there because they were all lined up up on the, there's kind of an overpass thing. All of a sudden, we were surrounded by more police than I'd ever seen. And the crowd started chanting. This was in 73, I guess. So soon enough after 68 that people were pretty leery. And there were still the CRS riot police stationed full time around Paris. Anyhow, they hustled us off to the police station. And I wish I could find it. I had the official ticket that said buffoonerie au public. Public. They just yelled at us for a while and then let us go.
Oh. When I emailed you about this, one of the things that you said is, today is one of my first days back in Aikido. And I was reading that you have your first degree black belt in Aikido.
Yeah.
And how does that relate to your clowning?
Well, I've been attacked a few times. It comes in handy.
Oh, and that's it?
No. I don't know if you know much about Aikido. It's been described as physical knock-knock jokes.
Right. It's a gentle art, right?
It's very gentle, but it's also redirecting the energy of your, and it's not even your opponent, it's your partner at that point. Redirecting their energy in an unexpected direction. And you do it with total relaxation. You never put any strength into it. To me, it very much relates to performing, but especially in choosing and working with audience volunteers, it really comes in more than handy. It becomes a whole philosophy of how to work with people. So you're never opposing them. You're never pushing them. You're never pulling them. They don't a lot of times they don't even know why they're moving.
Interesting.
So it's a fascinating study. I started doing lectures at magic conventions on these techniques, and it's really fun to see magicians really come alive to the idea that the person is not their enemy, not their adversary. They really become your partners.
So what I'm hearing from you is a lot of the stuff that you've done, you've taken outside sources and put them into your performing and your workshops, like the Aikido, the hypnosis.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pastiche of the things that I'm interested in, and that if I didn't have to have a job, they're what I would be doing.
Oh.
And I guess I don't have to, so they are what I do.
Well, the last thing I read on your bio is that when you were a kid, you had a passion for snakes.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to be a herpetologist when I went away to college. Some friends and I had a snake club, and we collected just about every non-poisonous snake that could be found in North Georgia, where I grew up.
Oh.
And then we used to order snakes from, when you could still do that, from Ross Allen down in Florida. So we had a whole menagerie of snakes, and I went off to, as an honors chemistry and biology major in college, and I got caught in a thunderstorm one day, and the building I went into happened to be the theater. Mm-hmm. They happened to be having auditions for a play. There happened to be a guy I knew from the dorm who was there auditioning. So I tried out, and I got a part in the play.
Oh.
And that was it for chemistry and biology. Although, you know, I'm reading a book called I Am Multitudes. It's about the microbiome in our bodies. I'm reading a book on the sort of sociobiology of trees. I just finished a book on zoonotic viruses. So it's still a big interest. I'm still a basic science nerd. And I think my teaching and my performance are very much influenced by a kind of scientific approach.
Yeah, it seems like it. Have you used some of those skills? I was reading that you teach workshops for students and professionals in healthcare. So have you used some of that, the scientific knowledge and such to help the healthcare profession?
Well, it's more the work that I've done on working with volunteers and using a lot of the theory and practice from the Ericksonian hypnosis is very useful for people that have to touch people, have to do invasive procedures. It's really teaching them how to, some techniques, some very concrete techniques for creating and maintaining rapport, which is the same thing a clown needs to do. I think of clowning as an invasive procedure.
All right, we're going to go to some fan questions. You want some fan questions, Avner?
Sure. If it gets any hotter, I'll need a fan.
Oh, no. Is it getting hot where you are?
I turned the heat up.
Okay. Every time I interview somebody new, I put on my Facebook group that you can ask me to ask questions of the person that I'm interviewing. So here we go. Al Hastings, a magician out of Pittsburgh, and Obadiah Thomas, a juggler, comedian, and school assembly performer out of SoCal, they asked the same question, and I actually had the same question. I'd like to hear his thoughts on classic clowning makeup in the modern age.
What does classic mean? What we think of as modern makeup, as classic makeup, is really pretty recent. I honestly don't think about it very much. We don't work with makeup in the workshops unless somebody brings it in and wants to. And my question for them is always, why are you wearing that makeup? What's with the makeup?
Right. What does it mean?
Yeah, exactly. And they usually don't have an answer. There's a kind of a canned answer about exaggerating features and things. But I think that developed when circuses started, you know, sort of Ringling Brothers, maybe in the 20s or 30s, were playing these huge arenas. So there was this concept of this kind of big mask that they were wearing. Yeah. But the idea of bringing that mask into an intimate theater or a hospital room kind of scares the bejesus out of me.
How did you come up with your character with the suspenders and the pants and the whole thing?
You know something, we did clowning at the Lecoq School, but back then it wasn't the sexy topic that it is now. It was 1 month at the very end of the second year, and I went through lots of different attempts at things, and what I'm wearing is very close to what I first put on. It's all very practical. He, as a character, is the janitor of the theater. So they're basically work clothes. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of gags where I drop things down my pants, so they're big pants.
Yeah, that's right.
I have suspenders because that's the easiest way to get big pants on and off. So it's all very, very practical. I had the sweater. I have a concept that I teach, another principle, that you should find interesting and odd ways of doing ordinary things. Mm. In the workshop I teach, I don't know if you've seen it on YouTube, someone folds a t-shirt perfectly in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
I teach that. I'm teaching a 2 second shoe tie that ties a perfect bow. I teach making a really kind of anatomically correct rose out of toilet paper. And each of these comes with a lesson. So I have, and that there shouldn't be anything in your show that doesn't have some gag or something interesting associated with it. So for example, one of the shows that I directed or co-directed with Julie, Iman Lizarazu, there's a place where she has to put her shoes on, and it was boring. It just was just a person putting her shoes on.
Sure.
Well, Iman is a classically trained ballet dancer and very flexible. So I had just discovered this shoe tie, and I taught it to her, and I said, now what if you, first she was just doing the shoe tie, and it was interesting. I said, well, I've seen you do the splits. Can you jump in the air and land in the splits? And she went, well, yeah. I said, okay, well, do that, and then lean forward. Tie your shoe in 2 seconds and just go whoop to the other side, tie that shoe and just levitate yourself off the floor. And it now gets applause every time.
Oh.
So I had this sweater, which I needed to, for the binocular gag that I do, but I needed to cover the back of the chair. So I needed the sweater, but I needed, and I liked it for the costume, but I had to take it off for other things that I was doing. So I developed a whole number about trying to get the damn sweater off.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's great.
And finally solving it, but solving it in an unexpected way. So taking a sweater off is a problem to be solved, not an activity.
Right.
So back to the question of makeup, I really don't think about it very much. I don't think it's the place to start for clowning. For example, with mimes, and I trained as a mime, the question that I always ask is, why are you wearing whiteface? And they don't know. Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. It really comes from Marceau, and before Marceau, Devereaux, who was the character in Children of Paradise. If you haven't seen that movie, you should. I think, is it linked? Well, you can find, it's called The Witness, and you can see the only example of pantomime blanche, which is Jean-Louis Barrault telling a story in pantomime. Mm. Well, that character with the big white sleeves was based on, and I'm not sure of the story of Tartaglia or Pulcinella from the Commedia, and he was a baker's assistant.
Oh, hence the white face.
Yes, he had flour on his face.
Ah.
And that's where the white face comes from. And just like the red nose, I know it's not true, but it's what I believe.
And it helps make a little sense of it anyway.
It does make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I don't think people should do things gratuitously because somebody else did it.
I agree with you. I've talked about this exact thing with a number of different people. Hmm. Just because the person that made it famous, for example, one of the people is Bozo the Clown. You look at Bozo the Clown and he had the clown makeup. Just because he has a white face and all of that doesn't necessarily mean you need to. If it doesn't fit your personality, it doesn't fit what you're trying to portray.
I remember the day that Lecoq came around and put a red nose on each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real ceremony. And I wore the clown for years. When I was wearing it when I played on Broadway. I had a lot of nice gags using the nose. I always used, well, I began with a putty nose that I spirit gummed on, but then I changed to a rubber nose with an elastic and had some really lovely gags with it. if there was one child in the audience, that's all they would talk about. Bring the kids. This is a great kids show. I did a show at midnight at a festival in Ireland. Bring the kids. It's a great show.
Midnight, yeah.
So I decided to try the show without the nose. I came on stage, got halfway through the sweeping, and realized that I had forgotten to remember to take off the nose. So I took it off, and because it had the elastic, I just slingshotted it into the wings and continued with the show. When I got to the napkin eating, I used to just tear just a cross in the middle of the napkin, tear the two eye holes, and impale the napkin on my face, and the nose held it on. And it was really a beautiful, beautiful image. And it always went in. I never had to touch it with my hands. And I got to that part of the show, and I have all this magic crap in my lap, and I'm going, oh no, I don't have the nose. And I had to sneak out from behind the table, go dig around and under the pin rail, find the nose, come back, finish the act. And it took me a long time. I don't know why, but it took a long time to figure out the nose and glasses, the Groucho thing.
That's a hilarious, hilarious part.
Lovely image, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So some really good friends came to the show shortly after I stopped with the nose. I said, so what do you guys think? And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, I didn't wear the nose. And they went, really? Oh. So that was the end of that. I used to do a minimal makeup. Same thing. I left it off one day and asked some friends, what do you think of it? They said, oh, wow. No, I didn't notice.
Interesting.
Didn't need it.
And it makes your life so much easier without makeup and a nose. And
it does. The critics immediately started talking about the existential angst of the character, the poetry of the show. There was no more mention of children, which is death to a adult, you know, for adult mixed audiences. As soon as they mention kids, adults stay away in droves.
I was just talking to a magician friend of mine about this, about how when someone says they're a magician, the general public generally says, oh, well, great. You'll be great for my kids.
Well, magician is my favorite four-letter word after clown.
Oh, it's the same thing.
It comes with a lot of baggage.
It does. And a lot of preconceived ideas.
Yeah. Mump and Smoot had a great way around it. They billed themselves as the clowns from hell. And then they practiced some cannibalism in their show. I never saw his show, but I admired it.
That scares me. All right. So let's go on to our next fan question. Obadiah, who was talking about the makeup too, he said, Avner, you're pretty famous. Not Tom Cruise fame, but variety artists know you. What does fame mean to you?
Well, I'm at a level of fame where I'm never recognized in public, so it's just fine.
I would recognize you.
Boy, wouldn't that be awful, though? When Jewel of the Nile first came out, I was in a video store with a friend of mine, and I heard talking from up front, and I went up, and the young woman behind the counter was looking at the box for Jewel of the Nile.
Wait, by the way, before you finish the story, Avner was the Jewel of the Nile in the movie Jewel of the Nile, just so you know. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I just had to clarify.
She was looking at my picture on the back of the cover. And my friend had obviously been telling her, and she looked at me and said, are you in this movie? I said, yeah. She looked at the picture. She said, no, you're not.
So it's easy to walk around as Avner, huh?
Yeah, people think I'm a rabbinical student or something.
All right, next fan question is from Suzanne Herring, an amazing performer out of SoCal, otherwise known as Schmoozy. She says, yay, say hi to my friend Avner.
She was in the very first workshop we ever did at the barn.
Was she really?
She was. She was brilliant. She was major, major.
And still brilliant.
She is. I stay in touch with her. In fact, I just heard from her about organizing a workshop in L.A. We did one, gosh, it must be about 10 years ago. I'm going to try to organize to go to the castle and play for a week and then stick around and do a workshop for a week.
Okay, well, that answers her question and Brett Bullitt's question, which was, when is he coming back to L.A.? So,
Maybe that's where I read it.
You answered it without me even knowing, All right, so Rob Balchunas, who is Rob the Balloon Guy, says...
He was in that workshop, too.
Oh, was he really?
The one in L.A., yeah.
Oh, okay. He has a little blast from the past for you. He says, I saw you perform in a college 3 miles from the house I grew up in Connecticut. For a primarily hearing impaired audience.
Oh, yeah.
You modified the paper balls over the head routine by ditching the kazoo and starting to sign. How do you adjust your show when you realize something won't work for the audience?
That's it. I had a very funny thing happen. I played at Arena Stage, and I came in one night, and they said, this is your sign language interpreter. Oh, interesting. And they went, oh, right. So this sign language interpreter, they had all the sign language readers on one side of the audience for this show. She got up and explained that I wasn't going to be speaking and that she would simply sit and watch the show and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And went through the whole show. At the very end, I came out, ran down the stairs, took her by the hand, brought her on stage, looked at her, did the sign for thank you. She turned to the audience and said out loud, thank you. When I was playing in Japan the first time, it's really considered rude to put things in your mouth and play with them and take them out.
Okay.
So the napkin eating was not a comedy routine.
Yeah.
More of a geek act. And they didn't get that it was a meal, because it wasn't resonating with their ideas about what constitutes a meal. So I got a nabe, which is a Japanese soup bowl, and I started eating with chopsticks. So now it not only was a meal, it was a foreigner wrestling with the problem of using chopsticks, and all of a sudden it became much funnier.
Did you know this before you went in, or did you do it one time and feel the audience?
Many times. I was there for about 3 months the first time.
Uh-huh.
It's constantly listening to the audience. And I remember a couple of, because I met a lot of people, and they said, I didn't understand that thing with the paper.
Oh.
Oh, well, that's interesting. You know, just slowly tried things.
You kind of figured it out.
Yeah, you figure it out, exactly. I know a lot of performers who talk will do, and now it's very easy on the internet to get some local people, local places, things to refer to. It used to be everybody just said, well, I was out in Cucamonga, but now you can name the suburb of the town that you're playing in.
And Cucamonga, by the way, is only about an hour from me.
Ha! Is that a real place? I thought it was just a joke.
It's a real place. I just booked a show yesterday in a place called Rancho Cucamonga. It is an hour from where I live.
Cool.
All right. So Rob Balchunas has another question for you. And I find this kind of interesting too. How do you stay in the moment with a show you've done for many years?
You know, it's not a problem. When you view the show not as a routine that goes from beginning to end, but as a series of problems to be solved. And there's a formula that is rooted in the breath. And this is another principle, that when you recognize a problem, when you see the problem, there's a sharp intake of breath, and it's almost the freeze, fight, or flight. It's the freeze part of fight or flight. Mm-hmm. And then, and this is a principle for clowning, the usual psychological response is, oh my God, what am I going to do? How am I going to solve this? Well, you can't solve anything when you're panicking. Mm-hmm. So the next, after the inhale, is the exhale. And the exhale comes with the mental word, interesting. Another inhale, I know what I'm going to do. And then you do it. And when it doesn't work out, which is a lot of the construction of physical comedy routines, you don't panic. You go, wow, that's even more interesting than I thought. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're going from point to point within this structure of solving problems, and the problems are real every time. It's not a problem to keep it fresh. And that whole thing of interesting, I think, is really the standard, should be the standard response for every performer. It makes you relax. And if you relax, the audience relaxes. Mm. It's a key point of establishing rapport. So a guy falls off a roof of a tall building. Halfway down, there's a clock on the front of the building. He catches the minute hand. He's hanging there. He looks down. He looks up. Interesting. And it's already funny.
Yeah.
So find everything interesting. Magicians will take a deck of cards, look at someone, and then give them orders like it's a military. Pick a card. Pick your own damn card. They're not interested in the deck. But if they look, and I think you're a magician, right?
Yes.
Try this next time you do a card trick. Just fan the cards a little bit and think to yourself, interesting. Look at the person and offer them the deck. You don't have to say pick a card. They will take one.
I'll try that.
And they will not be worried, because as soon as you say take a card, they're going, I don't want to screw this up. I don't want to be wrong.
So here's another fan question.
Okay.
This one cracks me up. All right. Zvi Kivi, who runs Balloon Artist College out of Israel.
Cool. Zvi.
Okay.
It's an Israeli name.
All right.
Like Avner.
Yeah, like Avner, yeah. All right. He says, Avner, do you really eat those napkins in your restaurant number?
You know, people ask me that all the time. If I tell them, yeah, I do, they go, no, you don't.
Yeah.
If I tell them, no, I take them out when you're not looking, they go, that's not possible. I was watching.
Yeah.
Pick your own answer.
Okay. Couldn't give away the answer even if you wanted to. All right. Can you give us a piece of advice for maybe the beginner or the pro and the pro?
You bet. Always take a nap before a show.
Oh boy. I know that one.
Take your wallet on stage, put it in a bag, put it in the wings, because if people are going to steal things around a theater, when the actors are on stage is when the dressing rooms are unguarded. Mm. And the kind of places we work, they're always unguarded. So that really good advice. Always take your wallet on stage with you and really take a nap. Lie down for 10 minutes. It will do you more good than any of the running around and worrying that you could possibly do.
All right. Do you have one recommended book? I've taken enough of your time. So do you have a recommended book? I'm sure you do. Have a recommended book and then I'll let you go.
I do. And you can order it on my webpage. It's called, and it's written by Julie Goel, my late wife. Mm-hmm. It's called Life in a Clown House, a manual and a memoir.
Would you mind if I put the link on your show notes on my website?
No, it's great.
Okay, I'll put the link, I'll click the link on your website, and when they click the link on my website, it'll take them directly there, and they can buy the book there.
Sure, and there's a ton of interesting stuff on my website. There are origami models, there's a butterfly that flaps its own wings made out of a dollar bill, there's a fairly complete bibliography, both of variety performing books and hypnosis and NLP books. There's the eccentric principles. There's a paper I wrote on working with volunteers. There's a lot of interesting stuff on the site, as well as access to Julie's book.
And what is the name of the site?
AvnerTheEccentric.com.
Perfect. And I'll put that link on the show notes page too.
Great.
Perfect. Well, thanks, Avner. That was really fun.
John, it was a pleasure. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I'm really excited about having you on, and I'm really glad you agreed to do this.
Maybe we'll meet in person one day.
I hope so.
Yeah, where are you? I have no idea where you are.
Oh, I'm in Southern California.
Oh.
I'm about right by Rancho Cucamonga.
That's right. You told me that.
I'm actually about 20 minutes from Disneyland. That's the best way of putting it.
Ah, okay.
Maybe sure. 40 minutes from the Magic Castle, an hour from the Magic Castle, maybe.
Okay. Very good. So, words of advice. If you can't succeed every time, learn to fail magnificently.
Beautiful. We'll end there. Thanks to all my listeners. If you found this podcast valuable, and I know you did, share it with your friends or on your social media. And make sure to join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.